Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to our podcast, Land and People. I'm Melissa Kimera. I'm a conservationist and artist here on Hawaii Island.
And I am Clay Chowernicht. I'm in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Management at University of Hawaii at Manoa. Ecosystems and fire is kind of my area of interest, and I'm an extension specialist. I would like to just iterate, as we always do, that the views and opinions expressed on the podcast do not reflect those of our sponsor or our employers. And so just to create a space that we can talk story and share our opinions, share our perspectives, rate, review, follow us. I always say this, that we kind of get these random input from people like on the street that, you know, out of the blue, and it's been all been positive. We think we're doing okay, but yes. We'd love to hear from you all. So, you know, rate and review, it helps people find it. And
share this podcast too with people that you know. It's just amazing. I was just, as an aside, looking a year ago, we had like 600 downloads total. We are up to 7,500.
Wow.
It's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Just in a year's time. So that's all for you folks. And we just want to say thank you all so much to our listeners.
So much. It really is. And my wife said it to me. She's like, you know, to both of us, we were hanging out. And she said, this might be like the most important thing you guys ever do.
It could very well be, which is fine with me. I mean, if
totally.
This is our legacy. Fantastic. Yeah. So as you all know, we've been interviewing folks on Maui, and we're wrapping up our season 2. This is the last one, so we say, for now, at least the last scheduled one for some time. But don't worry, we will be back. There will be more that come out kind of randomly this summer. But as you guys know, we've been interviewing people on Maui about the fires and so forth. And really, we're wrapping this up with a family who I'm extremely close with, the Romanchak family on Maui. They are Kama'aina. They are Native Hawaiian, part Native Hawaiian. And I'm close with Abigail Romanchak, who is not on this interview, but Ethan Romanchak is her twin brother, who is a co-founder of Native Nursery on Maui, which I want to say, truthfully, is probably one of the biggest, if not the biggest, Native Hawaiian plant nursery in Hawaii. For example, they delivered around 150,000 plants to state reforestation projects in 2014. They're now growing citrus for replanting in the central Maui former sugarcane lands, which have burned in recent memory. They're helping with that massive project.
By the tens of thousands. Got to tour the whole nursery and to sort of see commercial side ultimately. And we don't think about the applications, you know, or conservation in that realm all that often as like an industry. I mean, they've been able to make a living off of this, and actually the capacity that they provide is really setting some standards about how we can do these things at scale. These are the kinds of folks that we're going to be looking to help us solve some of those big production problems.
Both Ethan Romanchak and Jonathan Kaiser, who you'll hear midway through the interview, have a deep love of science and horticulture, and they're doing everything just so precisely and documenting it and making a living too, as Clay said.
Yeah. In addition to them being from Maui and, you know, just having that sort of insight over 20 years they've been doing this, more than 20 years, and sort of seeing the change and the interest. And
so pardon the audio quality. Again, we are in the field and taking a tour of Ethan and Jonathan's nursery up in Kula. So you'll hear us cruising around and talking about all that we're seeing. And then about midway through, Jonathan Kaiser, who's Ethan's partner, he drops in and talks a bit about his experience. And then we end up at Ethan's house talking about a whole range of things. So with that, here's our next guest, Ethan Romanchak of Native Nursery on Maui.
So now you can see the 4-acre property line with the Ohia and Alahe'e hedge, as well as 8-foot deer fence. But the original fence we built was this, about 1.5 acres out of the 4.
Yeah.
And literally on the back side of this, with cows, because the barbed wire to the ranch, they could get through.
Right.
So we manage 20 acres now. You know, I think for 7 years, our only equipment was a Sears Craftsman lawnmower and one of those trailers. And then we'd get like a hand-me-down golf cart.
That's so awesome.
And you're just slowly like moving the grass back.
Yeah.
Just one day. Seed processing?
We're a short-term seed holding facility.
Okay.
We do bring in a lot of like raw unprocessed seed. Mm-hmm. So we have fans and screens and short-term storage. Mm-hmm. Certain Fabaceae, yeah, like Mamani, Koa, you know, okay, those can be longer. But we've always told people seed labs need to be air conditioned.
Yeah.
And, you know, proper, you know, we've defined ourselves.
Okay.
Yeah. Michelle is our production manager. She's in charge of, we gave her a title. Like, all everything. But yeah. I just wrote our first job, or Alex wrote our first job description ever after 21 years last week.
That's
so that's the type of businessman we are. But anyway, she's in charge of like propagation, filling orders, making sure everything we say we're going to do gets done.
Yeah.
Melee's with us.
Yeah.
Part time, processing seed, spacing, packers, propagating, eating, watering. Everyone does everything.
So are your orders statewide then?
Absolutely.
I mean, because you're going through.
I mean, so Alex is our retail manager. He's out with the box truck at Young Brothers and Air Cargo. We ship out every Tuesday, Thursday.
No way.
Wow.
So palletized ag inspections for 45 minutes.
Wow.
YB to islands if it's more than a pallet, or Aloha Cargo if it's boxes.
Mm-hmm.
Seed comes into us like exactly like this. It gets categorized with different colored labels, and then, you know, hopefully planted right away.
Where are you getting the seed? How is that coming?
Here, there, and everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's an endangered species, we get the permit with MatCure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or we're on a permit, like, for Ojai with Kohoalave or so-and-so farm. It's endangered, and we're just selling at retail, and we're collecting it from a cultivated source. We get those red tags from MatCure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, we do about 10 endangered species just for landscape and retail.
Yeah.
So that's all from cultivated sources, usually like someone's yard next door, or your thinners, your mother's stock in a pot. If it's just common species, a'ali'ima'o, or whatever, we on site here, we collect our own seed. But if it's for a specific conservation project from a specific ecological niche area, of course that seed comes and goes right back to that area.
Yeah.
Right. And so are you depending on the project area to get you guys the seed typically?
In general, yes.
Yeah.
There's always, you know, exceptions to that.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, for example, Nick Agarastis, DLNR, NARS, Big Island, he wants plants from us. And, you know, of course, Waimea State tree nursery provides a lot.
Yeah.
The ule comes from that bush right down the road there. And if a landscape wants ule, we have ule.
Yeah, yeah.
But if it's Kohoalave genetics ma'o, and they have their own, then their ma'o seed comes to us and only goes back to them.
Mm-hmm.
So it takes, you know, someone like Michelle with all the experience, you know, from the rarest of rare pets, you know, Ane and Hank, handing over data-based, coded.
Yep.
We want the state to up their game with seed storage. Now, this state upping their game with running their own nursery, I think, is a whole different story. You know, the state's a landowner, all that seed's on their land, and you can't replant a whole forest after a fire, so there's going to be bulk seed needed.
Right, right.
You're making the plants to put out, and it's everything from retail to, you know, project-based, right?
To me, there's three different types of nurseries, right? Like, propagation nursery, where you actually make more plants and you need pretty high-level controls, misters. The production nursery, where you put growth on plants, which is like what you see out there, you know.
Yeah.
Saying you can't miss maybe 2 days without watering, and you gotta avoid disasters or if you have total loss. And then the third type of nursery is like a staging nursery, where it's like a safe place for a week or two. Because when it comes to reforestation, the day you need the trees is like 0.5% of the project. And if you want the trees there on that day, let someone else bring you the trees. You're micromanaging so many other things.
Yeah.
I don't know, there's definitely models to look at, let's say on the West Coast, like Oregon, California, Washington, you know, they, Rocky Mountains, they all have their, like, some government agency, natural resource divisions that deal with seed banking and nurseries. If you look at, oh wow, that county or that state did a really good job of providing resources for this land managing so over there it's like, oh, I can have a county or let's just say a state nursery in the Rocky Mountains, but as far as I can see, I can provide the right species.
Yeah, it's like,
and
10 maybe,
you know, and then there's probably a huge forestry industry that's subsidizing the work, so I say look to other states for that model, but I just think, unfortunately, Hawaii doesn't fit the parameters that make those successful.
Yeah,
I'm not trying to be like negative or pessimistic.
No.
What I've learned,
I think it's realism and healthy realism.
Pesticide safety station, hand washing, lunch. This is it. You know, this is
it's the whole thing.
Temporary power pole from 21 years ago, when you could call up Miko and say, permit. I need, you know, 100 amp service.
Right.
And that's as far as we got.
Nice.
Yeah, so original production, propagation, hand mixing in that little wooden tote, every single ounce of mix, once again, pre-expansion, post-expansion. We got back, now we have a diesel generator and a soil mixer and tractor.
Cool, and
so now we tote the mix over in these bins.
Yeah.
And this is just our retail operation. All these plants go to other nurseries that then they trickle into the box stores. Or we deliver straight to Kulutu Value, our local nursery nearby. Or they go to Inner Island shipments. If it's grown in a gallon pot, it's probably for retail. If it's grown in a dibble tube, it's probably for conservation.
Okay.
I'm kind of curious too, like, how's the challenge of actually just managing soil? Like, reusing media and getting access to the plants, because then that's...
Yeah, well, from day one, you know, we've been clean, clean, clean is our motto, right?
Yeah.
So with all this legislation and sitting on the, as a board member on the Farm Bureau, it's interesting because a lot of nurseries, especially on the Big Island, are up in arms about the ISCs. Working with Department of Ag, and you know, there's this whole new movement to clean up nurseries.
Yeah.
And I can see if I'm surrounded by an invasive species and it's a near impossible ask that it, and it could be a cost to my business. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But I can also, from our perspective, see, hey, it's your responsibility to grow clean.
Right.
So because we started growing mostly for reforestation projects, you know, from the rarest of rare, and not the rarest of rare, but let's say in intact ecosystems, to Koho Lagan, every in between, we would look so bad if we sent a pest out.
Well, now the consequences, I mean, a little fire ant is so gnarly.
Right. So that said, we're pokey-free, little fire ant-free, and we only use potted media, or I should say, bag media for our pots.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not using soil. So nematodes, not only that, but it could lure us out from shipping an item.
Right, totally.
Everything we do is just clean, clean, clean. I mean, you say, are you organic? And we're like, no. I love organic agriculture, and I love organic food, and I love organic principles. It's our responsibility. And that's a near impossible ask without using certain...
Well, the movement of weeds, too, through this stuff.
That's it.
I think people think about the pests and that, but...
Yeah, so we just, you know, between Jonathan and I, and also Jonathan's dad is Harold Kaiser, and he was admin for CTAR Ag Extension for years. And he's helped us a lot. PhD in soil science, but also just knows all the, let's just say, old timers. Yeah. So he's passed the baton because he's, you know, retired. But so now Ethan, not me, but another employee, Ethan, I'll introduce you to it. He's our fruit tree manager. Okay. He trains the applicators and keeps the logs.
Okay.
And
that's cool.
You know, we follow the labels. I mean, we just absolutely positively, we don't use any restricted use pesticides.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is, you know, I should say, safe when used properly.
Yeah, sure.
To label
it's a tool.
Yeah, it has to be a tool.
How many plants are you guys like potting up on any given day? Just to like give a sense for our listeners
the
volume of
that's a great
number.
So right, let's just say right now at this moment, in this little area, probably today, maybe 50 or 100, we call them liners.
Okay.
So let's say that could be a 7 cubic inch dibble gets put into a gallon. So let's say we're going to do 50 gallons today. But then again, right here in the racks of 100 dibbles, Michelle might drop 1,000 seeds.
Oh,
so in a sense, 1,000 dibbles got propagated here.
Right.
And Mele might take 200 cuttings.
Mm-hmm.
So that's in this area. But then you go out back, and Linda and Manuel right now are potting trees. And I think they have about 400 5-gallons to get to today.
Wow.
And then if we're running the other crew for citrus, and it was a production day for the Central Maui, you know, the big citrus contracts we've had, I think we were potting 4,000 a day.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
3,000 a day, 1-gallon citrus, tens of thousands. That's a good skill.
And most of them are going to be native Hawaiian plants.
Yeah, the only, well, let's put it this way. We do some other forestry product, crops.
Okay.
Recently, we've done sugi pine and redwood, mostly for the Big Island.
Mm-hmm.
And then fruit trees. But we're in the sweet Goldilocks zone for avocado and citrus.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the wind, I think, is the biggest thing to overcome when they move from our site to Central Maui.
Mm-hmm.
Avocado is coming. Howard's Nursery is doing a lot of coffee and macadamia nut. I mean, they are planting a lot of ag trees. And then they're doing onions and watermelon. And they did a batch of kale. And they've done potatoes. You know, so they're, for them to plant out acreage, the tree crops
That's
are kind of their long-term ag investment.
Mm-hmm.
it would have been so easy without money to just put the gallon pots on the ground, but right. the ants move in and you can't sell plants. So everything's raised, you know, benches, drippers, you know, we're on a 5/8 inch water meter for this 4-acre parcel. Mm-hmm. So your maximum flow is about 22 gallons per minute. Mm-hmm. So hence the 100, literally over 100 1-inch solenoid valves. Mm-hmm. So good and bad, right? We have more micro controls, but also more to manage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's all because we're on a limited water source.
Right.
What does that mean?
They have something called the upcountry water meter list, which is now closed. And unless you're on that list and you're working through that list, you can't get a new meter or even upgrade the size of meter. Yeah. So when we started leasing this, it came with a 5/8. We're actually kind of proud of the fact a lot of people come, oh, you're on a 5/8 meter? And it's like, yeah, every drop counts.
Yeah.
You know, instead of just going massive overhead and watching some of it blow away, it's like we can literally tell you how many ounces go to each plant.
So just putting it in my pot.
I can't even imagine just the labor to create this system.
Yeah, and
probably
then,
over time you did this, over years.
I guess another thing while we're here looking at these spaghetti tubes in this purple valve and white valve is we're really into plant nutrition.
Mm.
And so a healthy plant is a better plant for fighting off pests or getting established in the forest or your yard. So it's kind of not hydroponic, but those are liquid solution grade fertilizers that get injected at a ratio to give the plants every water. It's kind of like, think of Miracle-Gro, you know, like you put the Miracle-Gro, you water it. So it's spoon feeding. It's an efficient way of optimal growth. And for, right, if you're a nursery, if you can grow a plant in 3 months instead of 6 months because of nutrition.
Totally.
And then there's the hardening off phase, you know, wean them, harden them, lignify them, drought stress them before, if they're going into a forestry project. I think for a while there was this notion that native plants were yellow and sick and dying. And it's not that that's their genetic, it's the nurseryman behind the plant that matters.
Right.
So anyway, so this is the purple valve. So this means right now this valve is getting, and then, oh, it's a young crop, a new crop, we'll switch it.
Okay.
So we're not wasting nutrients.
Yeah. Right.
It's growing.
So I'm just curious, like this whole setup, which is, it looks like incredibly complicated to a layperson like myself with the nutrients. Yeah. Is this something that you guys figured out, or is this like industry standard? I mean, what level of creativity did you...
Complete hybrid. Jonathan had been landscaping for years.
Okay.
So skilled. I put in irrigation systems in high school for people. So we both kind of had the trade background a little.
Okay.
If we build it, then we can fix it.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, this one component, my greenhouse broke, now I'm waiting 8 months for the replacement part. It's like everything here is like down the road hardware store repairable.
And it's like pretty much hog wire.
Yeah, yes. It's like perfect. It's the concrete they put in, you know,
the right, the
six-inch pots fit 6-inch squares.
It's perfect.
A combination of resourcefulness and then reaching out to some of the old-timers. Mm-hmm. We can keep walking.
Okay.
Yeah. We can look at the propagation house. This is where shade drop down for summer sun angle. Once again, this isn't a kit shade house, it's just something we put together for as cheap as possible. Seat flats happen here,
and this is misting actually. I see
Just overhead once a day, and then we have other seat flats that strictly hand water. You know, you think you put some on a timer, you're winning, but sometimes, like today's cloudy, it didn't need a watering today.
Right.
You're losing.
Right.
So that the human eye is important for horticulture.
Sure.
So anyway, seat flats here. Then we come to this Gibble grow out. Same thing, fresh, but we can also sub-irrigate. So in the middle of summer, if it's 1:30 on a Friday, and you're gonna lose all of your trees over the weekend if you don't give them a good watering, and we're on a 5/8 meter and you can't run everything all at once, we sub-irrigate.
Cool.
And that's like a good soak, efficient way of giving them water. And then, so each level, each tray is set up for that.
Amazing.
Because otherwise, once again, overhead all day,
you
waste a lot of water.
Burning water.
Wow. This is West Maui Ohia, given to us by Mauna Kalawa Watershed Partnership.
Okay.
It's going back to Waiheke Ridge Volunteer Outplanting.
Sweet.
That's Pu'upahu Ohia, and you can see the genetic difference.
Totally. Mm-hmm.
So that's Haleakala Ranch, Allison at East Mai Watershed, Volunteer Outplantings, you know, in a fence unit up at Pu'upahu.
That's no joke. I mean, that gets really tricky to manage that stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I think for the average person, they think of it like the work that it takes just to sort through and maintain
the, yeah, you know, where stuff's coming from and not mixing too mixed a lot.
Well, you know, during my grad school at UH, my RA was with Alvin Yoshinago at the Seed Lab up in Lina Rio.
And my, just saw him the other night.
And my master's was Nelly Sugi upstairs in the teaching lecture.
Cool.
So yeah, I mean, I definitely like come from that background of like databases and tracking and it matters and landowners and accession numbers. So loss happens when a customer delays their pickup date or catastrophic loss from employee error or dead battery in a timer. You have to just mitigate and minimize loss or else you go out of business.
Yeah.
Propagation can be your whole
That's everything.
Tissue culture. All I do is little veggie starts. You're just a prop, but we're both propagation and production.
Right.
We don't want to be a staging merchant.
Right.
We don't want plants just sitting here waiting to be picked up.
Mm-hmm.
So, and look at that. Totally. That's Kalpoko. It's super red when it's juvenile.
Which one is that one from?
Kalpoko.
Oh, wow, that's so cool.
Amazing. That's what I was wondering when we drove in. I was like, look how red that stuff is.
Yeah.
Payroll, bookkeeping, emailing, all happens here. This is it. Okay. Not even enough room to sit down.
No.
Our office is 32 square feet, but it's paid. But it's paid for. I'm kind of fortunate when it comes to it as an employer and also in agriculture. We've never once advertised.
Yeah, I bet.
It's been word of mouth.
People want to come
like
here.
Like I was saying, literally this morning I was polishing a job description. It's the first one we've ever written.
Mm-hmm.
So Alex, who just showed up in the box truck, actually wrote it because it would be his worker under him.
Okay.
But it's kind of like you start and then you work your way up.
Right.
Alex started just potting plants, doing what Mellow does, and then it's like, oh, you're good at that, and you just work your way up to almost creating your own job title here.
Yeah.
So it's work. It's probably not like the perfect business model, but neither John or I have an MBA, or we just sort of show up to work every day and see what happens.
Yeah, but like, but you have made this viable for 20 years, right? I was
so
on
far,
your
so good.
Like, wow.
Yeah. Once again, I think it all comes down to low overhead.
Yeah.
In agriculture, there's just not much margin.
No.
So,
right.
And anyway, Ohia, so, you know, here's West Maui Ohia. That's, you know, my time working at Pooh Pooh Pooh.
Okay.
Seeds happen to fall in my pocket and happen to show up here. And this is where I'm saying, like, we have 60 of our favorite. But it's also kind of doing a favor. And this is all before Rod. This is before.
Right.
In retrospect, now we have these known clonal lines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And whether we're servicing, let's say, Rod, resistance research,
right,
or a landscaper who's like, my client bought that red one from you and wants the same one again,
right,
to finish her hedge.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So in horticulture, you, as humans, you can't help but to select or name, favor the ones that either A, are easy to propagate.
Yeah,
you know, that one has high rooting percentage in the cutting tray. Guess what? It went into the cutting tray,
right,
for years in
again.
A row.
Yeah,
or some aesthetic quality like green leaf, tight.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's Ohia. We could talk for weeks.
Yeah, ages.
Of course.
And then pilegrass that we talked about.
Yeah.
Because if the germination is known and good, you can afford to direct sow it. But if it's like sandalwood, alahay, or something that's like, oh, this could take a week, this could take 3 months, this could be horrible. Someone gave us the seed.
Right.
Sat on their dashboard for 4 hours in a Ziploc and it's all dead. We can't waste the media and time to direct sow it. So only if it's a known thing. So half of this stuff, I'd say, has all been hand-picked out of a seed plant and transplanted, transitioned shade. Now it's in its production stage, growing and ready to go out.
Right. Have you had luck? I know the alahay in particular is kind of hard to get.
There's that wasp that parasitizes the seed that if you collect a gallon of seed, you may get 3 to sprout.
Right.
So this is Jonathan's pet project. He took home our favorite genetics alahay, 14-foot tall alahay. So he took some of our, once again, our favorite, back to his home in Pukalani, has a few mother trees, and then he took the painstaking insecticide application.
Wow, okay.
Track it, bag each seed, and all of that came from that.
I see, okay, so you're really doing it, yeah. Wow.
So with before that, people would hand us all hay, we'd collect all hay, and we'd have, this would be 4 plants. I think we have about 6,000-8,000 all hay.
I got another one for you that we're always curious about. Olupua.
Same thing.
Have you
similar
been
thing.
Trying the same stuff with it? Have you guys had much success?
We have Olopu in our gulch here, I'll show you.
Yeah.
So we can monitor the seed collection. Awahi has shared a lot of Olopu with us over the years.
Are they doing rat trapping over there?
Is that how you pronounce
it? Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it's also win by numbers.
Yeah.
They have these amazing years.
Right.
You know, it's a year after a big rainfall year, and you know, Erica used to be here. Anyway, the team would be.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And it'd be like a windfall.
Yeah.
Then maybe 10 years would go by and it's hard to get a few. So, you know, just watching it.
Yeah, yeah.
Even when you have a lot of seed, it doesn't mean you're across the finish line.
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, crossing the finish line for you is getting the plants out. Fundamental.
For us, yes.
Because that's when you get paid. Oops, sorry.
And also...
And they don't die. You don't have lots of inventory, right?
But also it's a lot about communication with the project itself. Is the fence done?
Yeah.
Has the pre-emergent herbicide
done? Yeah, yeah.
Do you have staff? Is your truck running? We have to always, you know, kind of assess our customer.
Right,
you know, are you, like, do you execute?
Right. Have you helped them, other projects, kind of set up like staging kite nurseries so that you can have a little more like, okay, you guys, it's yours now.
We built a few over the years. Yeah. I get so many customers, whether they're large landowners or just a homeowner, walking into the nursery, although we're open by appointment only, sneaking into the nursery.
Oh, funny.
And saying, oh, I want this, this, and this, and they have a tiny car, and they want these huge plants. I'm like, slow down, take a breath. Hey, do you have labor?
Yeah.
Do you have a fence?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have water if you're in a dry area?
Yeah.
Do you have the thing laid out? And so my analogy is this. Planting plants for a project is like icing a cake.
Right.
That's it's like, great. First, you got to decide the recipe. Yep. Choose a recipe. Is it Duncan Hines or is it, you know, New York Times web thing? Okay, choose your recipe. Then go buy the ingredients. Okay, have all the ingredients. Make the batter.
Yeah.
Okay. And this could be, you know, site prep, fencing, herbicide, cutting rows.
Getting rid of crap,
Okay, preheat the oven.
Yeah.
That might be like, okay, I got labor, my truck's all running, I don't have a flat tire. Okay, bake the cake.
Yeah.
Okay, bring the cake out. Now you gotta let it cool.
Yeah.
You can put icing on a hot cake.
Yeah, it's totally. You gotta
now
let that
pick up
suppress.
The plants, which is icing the cake.
Yeah.
Now, not to say you're done, because you're really just beginning the next phase.
Yeah, it's the maintenance.
You know, I think so many forestry projects bite off more than they can chew.
It's that the volunteer, like, I mean, not to trash talk volunteer programs, but it's that idea that everyone's stoked about planting plants in the ground, but weeding is not as
sexy. It's like I see
sexy.
So much of the funding tailored towards the number of plants.
Totally.
And that's just, I think, a poor
we've talked about
benchmark.
That quite a bit.
You know,
totally.
Like I say, we're the icing.
Yeah.
So your budget, how much is icing, you know?
Yeah.
Pennies.
Exactly.
Your budget better include the kitchen, the oven, the truck to drive to the grocery store.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, once again, the analogy ends there because now you've really just begun.
Yeah.
Maintaining a fenced unit is...
It's like keeping that cake on display next.
I'm the worst salesperson because these people come in and nurse you and I send them home with an empty car. Don't make the sale.
Yeah.
And I send them home kind of depressed and overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And I've learned that that's more valuable than just being like, oh, here, you're ready, go. Take these 30 trees, plant them, you're all good. And then they perish.
Right.
Native plants are going to come with a whole host of like maintenance needs, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot. Come here and get as much. All hair, all of
it's really
as we may need for the whole year for that retail sector.
Yeah.
Now if someone says I'm doing 500 acres of Olapu, it's like bring your seed because you're obviously a conservation job.
Mm-hmm.
We need your genetics. If it's a homeowner that wants one random Olapu, we're not hiking out into a wild area to harvest seed
And it's at this point now, it looks like it's pretty low maintenance, eh? It's all like closed canopy ish.
Yes, no. I mean, there's little Manahuni here and it's named Jonathan Kaiser. He's so dark. And, he's amazing. He's a workaholic. But you're right. Once the canopy closes and the weeds have cycled, it's possible the maintenance should go down. And the other thing is, we are just getting out of a big, not big, but some rain.
Right.
And it's weird, right? You'd think we're in conservation. We love rain. It's kind of like managing
weeds.
20 acres of land.
Oh.
Rain means weeds and bad maintenance.
So,
avocado has to be grafted.
Yeah.
We graft on site. Mostly, we call him Uncle because his name is Ethan. So, and there's two Ethans. I'm Biggie and he's Uncle. So these are all 5-gallon avocado that he's grafted from the budwood here, right?
Cool.
So you have to have propagated material for fruit trees.
Yeah.
To make more.
Yeah.
Right. So by default, we're now avocado farmers. We just, right. I have hundreds of pounds of avocados we're giving away, or, you know, we're in the middle of Connolly Ranch now. We signed the lease pretty much a month before COVID blew up. Wow. So everything you see here is COVID era. We've done the best in business when other things aren't doing well. It's kind of this ironic thing, right? Like, people are stuck at home, they garden more. They buy more plants. Like,
true.
COVID happens and we had waivers. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of weird, but like we're on the opposite side of all the curves that you see. And honestly, besides being scared or cautious or apprehensive, it didn't affect us much at all.
Okay.
And so it actually made us having those dropping customers not allowed.
Right.
And so it's like the whole thing about, right, like it changed our business model where it's like, email us before you come for safety reasons, for COVID. But even when those ended, we're still like, email us before you come. So I think of anything, it made us more efficient and more defined. So we're potting, we're doing the bare root mainland fruit trees, apples, pears.
Oh, wow.
Persimmons, because parts of the Big Island of Maui are high enough elevation, you have enough chill hours. So those are brought in from California, ag inspected, of course, bare root, no soil, no pests. Because there's no budwood or propagative material in Hawaii to propagate some of these other varieties. So when I say, oh, we collect our own seed, that's not totally true. We do, this is one example of buying in a liner or a propagule or something.
Right.
Okay.
Someone else's work coming
here.
I see.
In general, though, like when people are like, oh, do you want to, we'd say, no, we would never bring your potted plant onto our site.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Even if you give it to me, because the risk of bringing in a new invisible pathogen.
Right.
So that's a trusted, clean, inspected source.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is all the citrus, right? All the citrus we do gets propagated in California. We visited the greenhouse. It's USDA APHIS certified. I mean, we're talking like, what is it called? Vapor locker.
Wow.
You know, the...
Yeah.
Don't let bugs get sucked in.
Oh, well, right.
Because for them, it's industry, right?
Yeah,
there's quarantines. And if citrus greening shows up in California, $1 billion industry is ruined. Yeah. Like Florida happened. So Asian citrus psyllid is the quarantine insect, which makes the California citrus propagators really, really, really clean.
Because
they have this $1 billion industry backing them. Getting off topic here, but the point being is we only trust that level of bringing other people's propagules in.
Yeah. Right. So did you guys just try it out and figure out, have you do anything different as far as which varieties of that, of like the stone fruit stuff that you can actually do here? I mean, how is
that? That's like my little, so like I wanted to do fruit trees for like years, but we're so busy with the natives, and then all of a sudden now we're doing fruit trees. Going to Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, and seeing agriculture in California, hands-on and grafting, and let's do it. But it's all about timing, right?
Yeah.
So finally the opportunity arose to start with citrus for Mahipono. By default, let's do avocado. And then about 15 years, I've been experimenting at my place with peaches, nectarines, apples, pears. We wear many hats, right? From like Kahoa Olave to apple trees.
Yeah, crazy.
Once again, here's a larger version of, most of what you see are sold.
Yeah.
No, once it goes into a 15 gal, it's for a landscaper or a project. Purchase. We don't just pot it up on a whim.
No.
Because that's where you can lose money.
Yeah.
But it takes years, right, to watch a seedling grow up long enough to flower and decide you're worth keeping.
That's the one, yeah.
I mean, just to tell our listeners here that we're cruising through these, and there are ohia of all different colors, yellow, red, peach, you know, every shade in between.
Yeah, pretty mixed. That first one is incredible.
Yeah, it is. And so, you know, are you guys just propagating these or are they ones that just came up and you're tracking the color and making more of them? And
Yes.
Okay.
So before it sells, she'll make all those cuttings you saw.
Got it.
Label it Malkanani. So even though our mother sells, we've made 300 more off of it right before it sold. Or I have this one in my yard. I live on Malkanani Road.
Right.
This was named after one in my yard. Vegetative propagation. So there's three different pathways they ended up here, though.
Mm-hmm.
One, people gave us seed from the wild for a conservation-based project.
Okay.
Didn't pick them up.
Right.
We grew too many. With their permission, they went into our gulch here, let's say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, that's a stunning. So that is straight from the wild.
Right.
Seedling.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out to be a stunner. vegetative propagation.
Right. So it's clones.
Second variation would be, we did a landscape 10 years ago. We go back to have a beer with that friend. Oh, he has seeding. We put some seed in a Ziploc, sow it. Same thing. A stunner comes out of that. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, that's an F1, right? It's not straight from the lab. And then third scenario would be, actually there's four. Third would be like, I was saying, a more purposeful, like that sunset. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, we love you. You're going to go in a seed flat. We hope most of your offspring are similar to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it was from something we did here on site purposefully. Like, and that could be an F2 or F3.
Doing crossing.
Removing stamens hourly, purposeful crossing. And what we notice is hybrid vigor. Right, when you get Ohia genetics all from one gene pool from the wild, great, keep it, that's important.
Okay, what about white Ohia? A, does it really exist? And B, have you seen it?
Well, we actually have a variety we named white Ohia.
Really?
But it was just a bleak yellow. My answer is I don't think so. But then again, in plant physiology, you have mutants, you have variants, you have, right? Like, I mean, with albino people are born that shouldn't be white. And then I think there's a really bleached yellow.
There's a light yellow one.
As the flower's aging and the whole tree goes through drought stress and it's in full light yellow bloom.
Okay.
So from afar, through binoculars across the ridge, which is our most botanist botanized.
Yeah. Right.
It looks white, but it's a bleached yellow. So that's my answer, is I've never seen one. I've never met someone
who actually has,
who I trust their botanical.
Your dad was high up there in the College of Tropical Agriculture Human Resources, UH. You grew up working in ag, so did you know that this is where you were headed?
I don't think...
On the land, or what? How did you find this?
Just time happening, and slightly by accident. I don't know that you could have asked me when I was 16 that this is where I was going to be.
Okay.
But by 19, I was committed.
Oh, really? What? How so?
I had two children, and,
and
my experience had been, you know, working with people by chance that were doing native plant installs and landscape.
Mm-hmm.
I've been constantly told, oh, we need more and more people providing plants.
Yeah.
So that seemed like, okay, open option. Having grown up with my dad, learning about legumes and rhizobias is kind of a thing to fall into. Learned a lot about koa growing up with him, because that's a legume.
How did you guys connect?
We were both interested in the same things at the same time. He'd been 3 years older, had gone to the same high school, and was that older, super awesome guy to look up to. Had moved home and was working up in the mountain, and I had a small nursery started. He was growing plants at his home. On his time when he'd come back out of the mountain, we both had, I guess, similar ideas about how to do such a thing.
Right.
That's so cool. But what I also find is interesting too, what Ethan was talking about, your interest in like figuring out the horticulture science of it, or both of you really, like you're tracking a lot of this information. You're interested in answering questions, I guess.
Well, also just to add to that, there wasn't a lot of research investment in, like you think about like, what were the sugarcane guys funding? Like that was what was horticultural science, right? This was everyone just figuring it out pretty much.
I think that right there kind of is what made it interesting to both of us, because we both have very much a scientific based approach to doing almost everything. And there was something out there that was, you know, not studied. A lot of our endeavors are not truly scientific, because that is a very different game, but we approach it to some degree just for our own knowledge.
Yeah.
I don't think we could probably publish anything in a, you know, sound scientific fashion, but...
Statistics was a very difficult course for me.
Yeah. It's...
But I love math.
Yeah.
Which is ironic. I like division, multiplication, and ratios. And you can go pretty far with that, but you can't.
My favorite was geometry, but I have to do a lot of stats.
In addition to the scientific mind, for like what you think of as like living plant science.
Yeah.
You can, that same mind, you have to blend the two, right? Like, how am I going to be a grower and engineer hardscape to support a live entity? And, you know.
Yeah. And make money off of and maybe track genetics too, and you know. Keep the plants coming in and out. I mean, it seems like it's a lot.
It helps if you just keep believing your own BS. And then occasionally check it, and when it's right, you're like, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, and it helps when you show up to work and you're like, yeah, okay, I'm happy here today.
Yeah.
Where'd I rather be? Somewhere else?
No.
Not really.
I think it kind of cheesy for a second. I think Ethan and I have shared ethical cores, I guess. And that can kind of guide you to a degree.
Yeah, it's great. You guys are good friends and business partners in this work for 20 years.
Funny, two people are always like, oh, this place is so amazing. And my favorite expression is, well, if you show up every day and walk around in circles on 4 acres for 20 years, it better look okay. Something's really wrong with you as a human being. So people are amazing. Yeah. Like, well, it's just time and consistency, right?
That's
continuity of management.
Yes.
Steadfastness.
Mm-hmm.
Slow wins the race type of thing.
What do you see? Oh, is there a pig in here?
Oh, yeah.
There's one. How about deer? They must be like right along this fence in here.
This fence right here, you could, you know, come at, say, 8 o'clock at night, shine a flashlight, and see 1,000 eyeballs.
Oh, my God.
Anytime, one time, kind of like World War Z. Each other to get in.
Licking their lips.
With that successful program the ranch used with hunters, removed, I think something like 8,000. I could be totally wrong. 8,000 from this area. From what we used to watch, you know, the last 4 years from here, used to be just little groups of them, and then just kind of apocalyptic line of them coming out of the forest every evening. And now it's real quiet, so I mean, they had a huge impact. And how long it's gonna last, I don't know.
That's interesting.
But I mean, they're definitely a problem, but they're also a tasty problem.
Yeah.
So we want a, you know, to some degree, some access to some number. We just hope that they're not getting into areas.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to run out on this island.
Yeah, it's just another challenge or dimension of doing land management or whatever it is you're trying to do. Keep them out to protect your plants, or thin them out to protect your forage if you got cattle. And people doing restoration, reforestation have been dealing with all kinds of ungulates, but just the options that are on the table if you don't have fencing, like, it seems to be not a lot of options that people are confident about, I guess. Like, the only thing I always think about is on Guam, they've got access deer for like hundreds of years, and they basically, when they do reforestation, they use this one acacia because the deer won't eat it, and it's like the only one that they'll really start with that, and then they'll, you know, put in natives underneath. They're like at that level where it's like, yeah, we just grow this one tree because
you can't get rid of them. Yeah, well, deer fence is like, you know, twice as high as a normal fence almost.
Yeah.
Twice the cost.
Yeah.
It's a nice looking one.
This one? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Professionally installed.
Yeah, I can tell.
And so they are fencing for all the ag down there then? I mean, that's...
Yeah. I know that was
the question.
Yeah, I can't answer it completely truthfully because I'm not the Mahipono.
Yeah.
No, but just like in general, yeah.
But yeah, I think there's, John, correct me if I'm wrong, I think there's like at two, if not three reasons they fence, right? Of course, deer.
Yeah.
But also, I think food safety.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm going to sell a crop, there's all these food safety hurdles, one of which is like, can Joe Blow walk into your orchard and poop?
Take it down.
And then you're selling fruit. So,
yeah.
Two is food safety, and three is probably liability insurance, keeping the fray out, security/insurance.
Yeah.
So I think there's three reasons they're building miles of fence.
I see.
As far as the deer, it's one of those large land units to successfully have zero deer presence, right?
Uh-huh.
Like a worker leaves a gate open, or a poacher cuts a fence. You know, like there's a million reasons they're going to sneak in and not be seen for days, weeks, or months.
Right.
We have an active local hunting sign-up program. And I think the question was specifically to citrus. And I think
that was coming from Chuck
yeah.
assuming that wasn't fenced. Like,
let's say it's fenced, but let's also say, let's be realistic, deer are going to be in there to some scale. At least if they're fenced, you can manage them, hunt them out.
Right.
You know, it's better than zero fence. But here's my take on citrus. So many times I've told people, customers, oh no, deer don't really like that. To be completely, you know, embarrassed a year later and like, oh, you ate that. I'm like, oh, okay, well, add it to the list. So citrus, It's not that they care about the thorns. Mm. Maybe there's some weird phenolics or weird plant like things they don't like. Mm-hmm. But, oh my God, they'll chew them to the ground. And then, of course, they'll rub them. But I think one thing citrus has going for them is their architecture, right? Mm-hmm. They can make it through the first 2 years. They send those lower lateral branches. And so it doesn't become a rubbing post.
Oh, interesting.
Like
okay.
Koa yeah. or Haulikoa or mango trees or many other things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's that, and then I think it's kind of like win by numbers. Like, I haven't heard deer taking down acres of citrus yet.
Okay.
Now, I'm sure they've chewed and browsed, mm-hmm. but I haven't heard from Mahipono employees that it's been catastrophic.
Yeah.
So I don't know, I think they're managing.
Yeah, among everything. So the point being, like, that is an intensively like managed agricultural.
Generally, they're not allowing for feed to grow in between, so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would be hard for them to get deep into the heart and just be eating citrus.
Well, I mean, as the orchards grow in too, though, I mean, geez, if they get in there, it's not going to be as fun and easy to hunt them out.
Right.
I mean,
I was thinking about when TNC, like, fenced the Na'u groves, you know, and did all that and tried to, like, do a deer push out of that small little postage stamp, and it was, like, took so many tries to get them out.
So I think it's still a evolving ecosystem that the orchard itself is creating.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's different when it's just by, anyway, who knows?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for being on our show. So
thanks for taking like half a day at your nursery.
Yes, seriously.
Honestly, it's
great.
Kind of nice to break it up, you know, 20 years of, like I say, walking around in circles. I like to break up my week with something different, and this is definitely different for me.
Well, and I was telling Clay, like, you know, we have been all this season, which we started last fall, after the fires, we've been talking to folks on Maui. We've been talking to the scholars about fire and weather and
water,
you know, water, everything under the sun, marine issues, everything related to Maui and the fires. And I thought, you know, to round out the end of this season, there's really no other family I would really want to talk to about Maui than the Romanchaks, because you guys have been here, you know, for a long time. And, you know, you folks have seen a lot of changes, really. I mean, I know that's kind of at the end of our questions, but I guess I would want to know first, you all started off in Makena, right? I mean, did your dad have a place down there, and then you moved up here eventually to Keokea, which I think for our listeners, I'll just say it's up here on, you know, leeward, dry Haleakala, beautiful view, 3,000 feet. So very different from coastal beach.
Yeah, well, I guess my family lineage on my dad's side goes way, 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 way back on Maui. You know, I'm a little bit Hawaiian, and my great-great-grandmother lived to be 100. So I got to know her. You know, I was young, but she was a part of my life. She was married to Fred Maneri, who was an engineer at the HCNS sugar mill. He designed a lot of the turbines and the power system and bagasse. And I mean, I think 50-something years, he was the engineer for the mill. So my dad grew up on Maui. You know, and Makena was the end of the road.
Yeah.
I mean, the real end of the road was the end of the sugarcane fields in North Kihei.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was dirt road through Kihei. Then there was real dirt road through what's now Wailea, and then lava into Makena.
Yeah.
So, you know, he had fond childhood memories of staying at a house that was tied to the plantation, which is now Maluaka Beach,
mm-hmm.
you know, where the Prince Hotel used to be. So yeah, I think growing up on Maui, my dad had such fond memories of Makena that after his education, you know, on Oahu and then at University of Michigan and then in Oregon, and started a family back on Maui in the early 70s, he was lucky enough to have a friend, business partner, and so he hui'd up and I think had a half acre or acre in Makena.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, you know, it was a half hour dirt road just to get to Polo Beach, which is the Wailea area.
Yeah.
So we went to school at Lihikai Elementary in Kahului, but our weekends, like, we weren't there during the week, right? Because you'd have to wake up in the dark. It's like a, not a snow story, but it was an hour drive from our house to Kahului.
Right.
Oh my gosh, right. I didn't know that.
And so we'd leave in the dark, get home in the dark, but weekends were, you know, super memorable childhood, you know, almost like fairyland now, you know. Mm-hmm. Nobody was down there. I mean, there was hippies living on Big Beach and local fishermen down at La Perouse.
Yeah.
You know, a few of the residents spotted throughout my kennel, but it was just different. Like my dad.
Country.
Yeah, it was different. It was just a different era. Mm-hmm. So yeah, everything changes.
And
yeah.
It would have been rural. You would have been like not watching TV.
Oh yeah, no, there was no rabbit ears. Yeah. Rabbit ears didn't even catch TV. Yeah, so we all grew up, you know, playing with each other and, you know, in the ocean and just exploring the willy-willy trees behind us and looking for hermit crabs in the tide. You know, it was just pretty cool looking back.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then the family moved because, yeah, of course, my mom got a job up country teaching, and then my older brother, we started high school up in Mahua.
Oh, okay, that's what...
So that was the move, right? It was an impossible drive.
Yeah.
And then my folks and, I guess, for the most part, myself, have lived in the up country area.
All this time.
You know, of course, I've lived on Front Street, you know, right across from Shark Pit for several years when I was working for Pu'ukukui Watershed, you know, Maui Land and Pine. Mm-hmm. So I've lived on the west side. I've lived in Paia, right on Paia Bay for a part of my life. I've lived all over Kula. Yeah, Makena is definitely a pretty special place in the late 70s and early 80s.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I bring that up because, I mean, I'll be honest with you, Abby, your twin sister, has similar fond memories and has talked about how, you know, there's a little bit of sadness going down there because it has changed and she doesn't want to spend a lot of time going down there. And, you know, I bring that up because we have talked a lot on this show. It's come up quite a bit about this rapid commercial development that happened on Maui, concentrated in the 80s and 90s, you know, and how it was really, it was kind of extreme in some ways. I mean, like Waikiki sort of happened.
Over a longer time. Yeah, it's sort of been more entrenched in a way for our lifetimes at least.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you could interview people with a lot more direct knowledge of all the steps that occurred from zoning changes
to.
And I think it all actually started way before the 80s and 90s, right? I think post-World War II, it's kind of like, what is Maui?
Yeah.
Agriculture, you know, sugar cane and pineapple, and really not much else. I mean, even when my folks, when my dad moved back to Maui after, you know, his education, Maui was tiny. And even when I was a little kid, it's like, it was growing, but it was still like, oh, that family and that family. And oh yeah, they went to that high school. And you kind of like knew who people were in general. And then all of a sudden it was just like, I mean, you know, my sister Abby and her friend Emilia used to play this game. Like, have you seen the new stoplight on Maui? It was like this quiz game where every time they saw each other, like, oh yeah, there's a new one. And it was, you know, intersections were popping up that fast.
Yeah.
And so, of course, Makena is, but like I said, I think the writing was on the wall for South Maui. I mean, white sand beaches, you know, and so some politician and some planners made the decision probably, I'm just guessing, in the 60s. Mm-hmm. You know, that's when Kanapali was zoned for, and that's when South Maui was.
Okay.
So it's those master plans that occurred decades before what we saw in the 80s, where I think you'd really trace the heart of who decided which direction Maui was going.
And it would have been that time. I mean, you can look at the history of like when agriculture starts pretty
much crashing out. I mean, we all say, oh, poor, not poor, but HCNS and Maui Land and Pine. You know, Maui Land and Pine is the largest private employer on Maui for years, if not decades.
Of course.
And HCNS, but so I think they were already seeing the writing on the wall that plantation agriculture wasn't making sense. So, you know, probably behind the scenes for a decade, there was talk of what's next for Maui's economy, what's industry.
Right. Which is so cool because that leads us right back to like the field that you're in, which is agriculture, you know? And I mean, I just think it's amazing. I mean, Abby's not here to talk about her work, but it's so, her work closely so connects with conservation, you know, the expression of her artwork and the love of the land. Clearly, like, you both have such a deep love of the land and it expresses itself in different ways. But, you know, what point do you think, like, growing up, you felt like, I want to do something with the land, I'm connected to this place in that way? Did you have a sense for that?
Well, there's definitely, I mean, when it comes to like conservation, I'll just say native forests or native ecosystems or native plants, it was definitely, you know, an internship with the Nature Conservancy after high school, 1995, with some of the pioneers and, you know, legends of conservation. I mean, some are still on island, but Paul Higashino was my, you know, my mentor and boss in the field. Mark Defley, Clark. I forget his last name. So yeah, I still call that like this golden era of conservation where my eyes were open. I mean, come on, waking up in a pristine rainforest, flying in helicopters at 18 years old, learning botany, killing pigs, fixing fences. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
So obviously when it comes to like the native plant conservation slant to what I'm doing, it was that. And then later with Hank Oppenheimer up in Pu'ukukui, two or three more years of my life.
Oh, okay.
Botanizing and camping and building boardwalk and doing weed transects. So, I mean, two pretty, you know, special phases of my life.
Formational experience.
You know, Hank's work ethic and his botanizing skills.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like, sure, I was young, so whether I knew it or not, looking back, it shaped who I am. You know, I'm thankful to have had those jobs. But as far as just straight up agriculture, I think it's funny now that I have kids and you've read all those, like, you know, you just hear about, do kids do what they want to do, or is it, do you steer them? And it's obviously a combination.
Right.
But I probably could trace it back to growing up in a place like McKenna, where, you know, just looking at inchworms fall out of a kiawe tree as all you did all day Saturday. Probably somewhere like implanted in me to like slow down and look at stuff. And that's kind of, I think, what plant sciences are about.
Yeah.
You know, whether you're a botanist or horticulture or any form of naturalist.
So,
I think so many folks get into that, and then it's this conservation field where it's like non-commercial, right? Like it's all grant funded or whatever. And to kind of find a niche that you guys found is in the sense of coming at it, I guess, you know, thinking that there's a way to make a living, you know, it's just pretty, I hate this word entrepreneurial. The, what you shared today, like the size and the scale of what you're doing isn't what you maybe could have imagined 20 years ago.
Oh yeah, not my wildest dreams, I think.
But to see where it's gone is really incredible. And then bridging right into agriculture, right? Like
Still love native plants, but I don't know, I'm kind of fixated on fruit trees at the moment. Kind of wondering like what's next.
They're pretty core to like human.
I think you're in good company here.
Yeah.
Because I think we have been talking a lot about, you know, the transition of abandoned agricultural lands into becoming productive again, you know, and how critical that is for so many reasons.
It's funny you bring that up because, like I say, looking back, you know, it's just so fun and easy to do. When I was working at for Maui Land and Pine Company, I just got to see the end of the last pineapple fields planted in Napili, you know, the west side. There's still pineapple on Maui.
What
don't
are
get
we talking
wrong.
About? 2008 or something?
Oh no, earlier than that.
Earlier.
I started with them in 2000, and I think by 2003 they were just about wrapping up the last crop. But in close recent history, all the sugar of West Maui had just ended.
Yeah.
Close enough in my memory that like
99
of course,
or something like that was Pioneer Mill.
Anyway, and I remember talking to Hank and Randy Bartlett, who was, you know, steered the ship for Pu'ukukui Watershed and did amazing things, and being like, I never forget this. Don't the sugar guys have to do something as they exit their land? Like literally just...
You asked the question?
To Hank, to anyone I knew.
Yeah.
Like, is there some code, rule, law, ethic, anything, where you're like, when you do ag for decades and then you stop... You can just walk away. And I was asking the question, I remember, about sugar, because pineapple didn't start yet. And of course, looking back now, like, okay, post-pineapple, you know, we're talking about besides gentleman estate subdivisions.
Right,
but
which
like,
are
like,
super
leave the,
small.
Leave the land in some cover crop or conservation plan or mitigation. Because, you know, you stop doing agriculture and within a year, the ecology of the field has changed. And within 10 years, it's completely different.
Yeah.
Whether it's fire prone or
weedy,
whatever it is. And so when I left Maui Pine and I had to choose a topic at TPSS at CTAR, looking back, it's a bit silly, but my whole master's was on the propagation of Uluhe.
Oh, cool.
Because it's like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if there's some rambling, super crazy, gnarly thing that no one would want to walk
like
through?
That's like the million-dollar question.
Right, so I spent
that's a good one.
That's
two
amazing.
And a half, three
I didn't
years
realize.
With Nelly Sugii trying to crack the code, and Richard Kiley was my main professor, and a few other on the committee. Uluhe.
Okay, so tell our listeners, what did you discover?
Hard as hell.
Yeah. Well, I mean, typical grad school, right? Like, time is ticking, life is calling.
Yeah.
Let's wrap this up. You know, it could have been a 10-year master's or a 20-year PhD or whatever.
Yeah.
First of all, it's fern, and ferns are weird.
Mm-hmm. You know, they have two stages, right?
The can get the meteophytes going. Yeah.
So I did a straight up division trial. I'd basically dig out a chunk and try to make it survive. I've heard of stories on the Big Island, like people taking a scoop with an excavator and just plop it somewhere else. And it kind of takes, it needs that like mass, that inertia of...
Like enough of a
because one genotype, you know, one individual can take over 2 hectares of land. You know?
Right.
There's a famous Peter Vitasek, all his research on the Big Island. Yeah. I think it was his. So I think that just speaks to if you just cut a little tip cutting of a luhe, it's reliant on getting water from 2 hectares of its body.
Right.
So immediate transpiration shock and just so you can't really take cuttings, you can't even do small divisions because it's tied to this huge leaf area index of plant, right? Mm-hmm. So then I went to the lab and did aseptic and tissue culture spore propagation. Of course, Nelly was just amazing mentoring. And you know, you can germinate the spores and make them, and then hardening them off is really hard. So just like anything coming out of tissue culture, that stage 3, stage 4 transition is so crucial.
The shock of like,
right, like
real
okay,
media
you're fine in glass and now you come out in vitro or, you know, artificial light and 100% humidity and perfect nutrients and hormones. Now meet the real world.
Yeah.
So honestly, it comes down to facilities. So, you know, I was such a practical get out of here grad student that like, I think in my defense of my thesis was, oh yeah, you know, there's these commercial fern nurseries. There's one in tech and sending spores to them and letting them play with it for 5 years would be the best, you know.
Right. Like, yeah, you're like, this needs further.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, typical needs further work. Yeah, and basically it needs further facilities. And so, you know, then when I was in California, you know, I'd saw what a big nursery can look like.
Okay.
You know, and nothing against Nine Arboretum's facilities, but, you know, that poor little outdoor facility that Nelly and Alvin had, and Lauren Weisenberg, who was in the lab with me at the time.
Yeah.
Hard to transition a tender fern.
So not feasible at this time.
Correct.
Okay.
We were trying. We had someone who wanted to try when I was a botanist over in Kauai, and it was just hard to find spores sometimes. Like just
exactly.
Like,
yeah. No. I mean, every step of it was a challenge. But I figure, you know, if I had spent that much time, then everything else would be easier.
Yeah.
And it's kind of been true. You know, like take an archaic, you know, because you know on the scale of like ages of the earth, it is one of the like oldest fern families.
It's everywhere too.
So it's just really... this like archaic beast that loves water but grows on steep cliffs and needs drainage.
Soils.
Yeah, it's like kind of the ultimate weird plant.
When you get out into Micronesia, it's in these fire-prone savannas. It's like it just loves disturbance.
It's just a weird one.
Yeah.
So.
Crappy acidic soils. No, that's like the dream, right? You could just roll out carpets
or hydromulch it or
Out
of a helicopter and poof.
Amazing.
But that tells me that you are already thinking like, how do we...
Practical.
Right. How do we put native plants out there, you know,
at
scale. Yeah, that's what you were thinking about.
Well, yeah,
already
and it's
got
to be feasible and successful.
Yeah.
And not require unrealistic man hours.
Yeah.
Oh, how cool is that? That's like, that's so funny because I was like, I think we were probably around at the same time because I was definitely overlapped with Lauren. So I was in the botany program like 2001 to 2003, somewhere in there, 2004.
Yeah, I was 2003 after Maui Land and Pine till 2005 in TPSS. Yeah, Lauren was sort of my boss in the seed lab. I mean, Alvin ran it, but.
So we've talked already about, you know, the citrus that you're growing, which is, I mean, pretty amazing, that operation. Is there any other project, either past or present or future, that stands out in your mind that you learned a lot from? I mean, one we did bring up, we haven't had a chance to talk too much about it. It was Polypoly fire. Did that start things off for you guys in terms of like volume of production?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that was kind of a benchmark in what we were doing. Yeah. It's when we were able to flip the switch from landscaping, you know, to pay the bills.
Okay.
To, oh, wow, we're busy. We're full time. Even though it's still just me and Jonathan.
Yeah.
And maybe we had one sort of casual labor. Yeah, so that was 2007. I remember the day of the fire, we were actually down at a Maui Nui Botanical Garden plant sale. I mean, we used to hustle like Saturdays, like Toyota pickups and drive down.
Set the tent up or whatever.
And I'll never forget, we're wrapping up and I'm looking up and just watching Polypoly.
Rage.
You know, it's that high humidity or low humidity, weird weather pattern. And it was just like, oh, you know, it's a moment you don't forget, right? When you look up the mountain and see massive billowing.
Big plume.
so, you know, it's not like the first thing I thought was, ooh, restoration. It's like, oh, how sad, you know, like, yeah. You know, and then I think David Leonard, Lance De Silva, and that, you know, this sort of emergency funding came through.
Okay.
And I don't know if it went out to, I think it went out to bid. And I think, honestly, ever since 2007, you know, you had to put in a formal procurement bid. Mm-hmm. The Maui nursery couldn't handle the volume. So they put it out to bid. I think we've been in contract with the state ever since, up to the present, you know, for different purchase order amounts, yeah, or different groups. But like, you know, right now we're going for Kauai Dofa,
oh,
Big
cool.
Island NARS, Maui Dofa, and some of their subsidiaries. Anyway, so the thing came out and had redwoods on it. And oh. So once again, I was like, oh my God, new, cool, new challenge.
Right.
We've never grown a redwood. How are we going to bid that? And we did, and we figured it out. And Ohia Koa Mamani Ali. And, you know, in hindsight, nature bats last, pines are gnarly, there was pigs, it wasn't a fence. It's, you know, forest reserves are lands of many uses, right? Yeah. There's hunting, there's hiking.
Yeah.
Sort of fence it off and use herbicide is just a weird practice in a forest reserve.
Yeah.
A few of those pine species are just relentless. They thrived after the fire.
So are you saying that, like, the pine forest just became the pine forest again?
Well, there's different ecozones to the fire. Okay. You know, the Mamani shrubland above, let's say, tree level, sort of tree line. I think the Mamani and Ali had some success for a while. You know,
okay.
It took and grew. Yeah. The koas did okay, but luckily there's no gorse per se in that zone.
Area. Yeah,
but there's
yeah.
still blackberry.
Yeah.
Right.
And there's still carpets of pine seedlings. So, you know, I think Lance and, you know, if folks did take data, I mean, it would be a little sad survivorship. And, you know, we'd go hiking and mountain biking up in the air. And, oh, look, there's a kochi. That must have been the planting.
Yeah. Mm.
Oh, there's an ali. I wonder if that's a native, natural one before the fire or something
yeah.
planted. It's not like you can point at it and it's this, like, beautiful forest you recreated.
Right.
I think it was honestly just similar to the wildfires of, you know, recent on Maui and Lahaina and Pula and Olinda. There's always a knee-jerk reaction to get money and spend money. I mean, this whole interview, I'm speaking as Ethan, a resident of Maui,
yeah,
and business owner, but I'm on the board for the Olinda Kula Soil Water Conservation District.
Mm-hmm.
So I followed a lot of the monies, I forget the acronyms, that have been applied for and received. You know, it's like buffalo grass.
Oh, yeah.
Fencing.
Just hurry up and...
Wood chip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do this. And Lahaina, I think, is still resolving their plan.
Mm-hmm.
But... Mei Nakahata really took the lead for the Central Maui Soil Water Conservation District, and they kind of dovetailed and took over, because most of even the Olinda Kula fire fell on the map to the Central Maui District.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
And you know, when we drive around Kula Olinda now, what is this, how many months after the fire?
Yeah,
6 months.
There's a lot that's happened thanks to the federal money. I mean, chipping of dangerous trees, chipping and spreading the wood chips to stop erosion, you know, all the different erosion logs. That's all been paid for and rushed thanks to it. But I think in larger scales, like all the dry grasslands, what are you going to do?
Yeah, what are you going to do?
Planting natives? No.
No.
Throwing buffalo seagrass out? There's already some there.
It's already there. Right.
So we have this knee-jerk reaction to do something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when it affects a small individual residential landowner, if the federal government can pay for the services to stop erosion on their land and have a mudslide come through their back door on the first rain, I'm all for it. But when it comes to unrealistic expectations from a management practice that looks good on paper.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's it. It's like you see this. It's like the devastation, so the immediate sort of shift in the landscape is shocking, right? And so you have this gut like, oh my God, we gotta go. And then a lot of folks that, it's good because it raises interest, like people care. I mean, obviously that's just like the best part about it. If there's any kind of like silver lining is it gets people engaged, but then there's not a deep appreciation of the work to maintain. It's like we were saying at the nursery, like that's just the beginning, right? You put the plants in the ground, like that's the beginning of the work is starting then. And so that idea that, oh, we got to just get out there and like put trees in the ground. And, you know, I think that a lot of folks with a longer history in that kind of field, doing that kind of work, have an appreciation of those challenges and that there's no quick fix.
Yeah. I mean, there's been some great groups, you know, Joe Imhoff, I forget the name of his, Nakua Manu, but I don't know if he has a second business name. You know, they're helping implement a lot of these practices. And I mean, they're employing people. They're doing the right thing.
Yeah, the chipping to
yeah,
do,
exactly.
That's like,
I mean,
the best thing you could do for the soil right now. So.
you have to look at every single specific instance and weigh whether it was worth it or not. So, you know, I don't mean to sound like, oh, don't do anything. It's just going to do what it's going to do.
But every little step
you take helps. But I hate it when people have these unrealistic visions of what can be done.
Well, there are things that can be a waste of resources, frankly. I mean, it's just, that's just plain and simple. And you're going to have, it's like what Mike Walker calls the disaster industrial complex, right? Like, so money's floating in and you have, people want to do something with it. They want to be proactive, you know? And so, and this is, I would say, relatively rare. Like Poli Poli was probably another example where, I mean, I can talk of how many freaking fires happen where there's no resources. There's no resources to do anything afterwards. And so, you know, you see that over and over again. It's on the other side, you can kind of get cynical, like, wow, you know, what's the, you didn't do anything on the when the fire burned up the mountain above Lahaina in 2022, right? Like there's all these things happen over and over again, and we don't have resources to actually respond. But just to understand that I'm coming from a more just, you can be patient, right? Like the grass is going to come back in. I am all for trying to change the vegetation to something that'd be less likely to burn, but it's a long-term process, a long-term game.
I mean, I think we all know the saddest or sorest thing to see after a fire is watch topsoil fly down the mountain into the ocean.
That's
whether it happens with agriculture, you know, poor management practices of land with agriculture or after a fire, we all know, like, that's the, you know, I'll never forget, like, Kihei residents saying, we saw pine cones on the beach, you know, after the first big rainstorm after the Poli Poli fire. It's like, I guess you probably did.
Yeah.
And I guess that means topsoil that's scarce that high of elevation of pine trees is now on the reef. And that's just not right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I think just topsoil erosion mitigation to me is, and invasive species coming in after a fire.
Yeah.
Those are like the two things like that, if you could, you know, whatever engineering and dollars can go in towards mitigating that. Yeah. To me, like planting is kind of like I say.
Yeah, that's number one. I mean, the soil is, you can't build that back.
I mean, I do want to actually.
So, yeah, but back to the question, that fire and doing business with Dofal and talking to Nessa Silva, it kind of paved the way for a relationship to provide plants. Mm-hmm. And so even if there's not a fire, I mean, Brian Stevens helping map out and find and establish and fence and not Kulanar. So even though it's a fire, just years of goats and some, you know, that high, you know, there's, it's a sacred place out there.
Yeah.
But way up high, seeing bare earth, just, we all know in our gut, no matter how much you love hunting or want protein in your freezer, it's just wrong or sad.
Yeah.
You want cover.
So anyway.
I mean, I do want to get into sort of like just the problems that have happened here on the Liebert Slope. There's just so many. I think of like, I'm always thinking about you guys when there's a fire or floods, you know, and like you and your family, like literally I was explaining to Clay, have been like trapped over here during the like numerous times. And I think about like the parallels with like Hank, you know, and all the fires that he's seen. And it's like this latest thing is just one of, I mean, it's terrible, obviously, but this has been going on for some time. And you guys have sort of, you have sort of the front row view of the changes that have happened down there. And then also, you know, the experience of drought and the flooding. I mean, like, how have these things affected
it's funny,
you?
Like, we all have really vivid memories of the event, you know, I remember the week before, because I was watching the weather that week because I was on a boat and I knew this weather was coming and we had issues and let's get back to Maui because this weather's coming. And and we could have come into a burnt Lahaina. And then there's also this, anyway, one thing is like in the heat of that, of a fire, any natural disaster, a flood, a storm, it really sits with you. And in my case, it was like family, right? So my brother was on lower chemo and they were evacuated. So they're like, no, it's on Hidesta. We're headed home to your house. We're bringing our dogs and our birth certificates. I'm like, wow, this is real. Like, and they're just the other side of Kula. And then Abby and Jordan, hey, it's smoky here. We're going to come to your house. And then my aunt, who's in a wheelchair with MS and had COVID, who's, you know, my auntie, she's older. Hey, we're trying to get a hotel somewhere with a handicap and we can't find one. And we're not sure if we should be driving at night with all the fires and all over. So she ended up here. And so there's this forever memory of our family coming together tighter than it ever has.
Yeah.
Or may, you know, and it's sad to say, but I mean, that's something, right? It's like, and Lahaina, we're that community, even though it's sad and tragic, it is a like blip in history that can serve for powerful ties moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, it's shifting the ground.
That's the moment of.
Yeah.
But that's not the first time. Like, you guys have come together as a whole entire family, like during floods, like, and other things too. Like, these disasters have kind of been like,
well, it's funny, right? Because
several times.
I'm old, but not that old. And you talk to old timers, and you're like, and it's always like, what is your scale of reference, right? Like,
yeah.
We were like, we're in the worst drought. And you talk to someone who's 80, and they're like, no, you weren't here on Maui in the 30s.
Right.
Maui was blowing away. Right. Like, the whole island was a dust bowl. And you're like, oh, you mean, no. And they're like, old timers, like, well, we've seen this. Now, is it escalating or becoming a different pattern?
More frequent. Right. Yeah.
Maybe. I have noticed, like, I feel like every winter we get one huge, either Kona low or bomb, weird weather, and we just get pounded, and all the water delivery, county water lines get blown out in the gulches, and we're out of water and power for a week.
Right.
Which is kind of fun and fine.
Yeah.
Now, it's sad. Now, with the fire, though, it was scary because our water source was cut off. Mm-hmm. Nothing scarier than owning, taking care of live plants without.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Because they had the water turned off and we're on county water.
Right. I didn't even think about the water. Yeah. And
Then we're like, well, if the fire keeps coming up the mountain, because we could see flames from where we were today, looking down, you know, that was the Pulehu fire. Mm-hmm. Well, should we save our water for fighting fire or for keeping the plants alive? Or at that point, I guess it won't really matter. We're not letting all our plastic burn. Like, so we're kind of in this like state of, oh, too bad. We should have put those 10,000 gallons of water storage in that are sitting there. You know, like, you know, that we could have, should have been more prepared. But anyway.
Yeah.
Live and learn.
But you were fine.
It turned out okay.
Okay,
because, you know,
I mean,
we have a week of storage, you know, and we're not totally unprepared.
Yeah.
But it is, it's like, they're my livelihood. You know,
like you said,
and it's coming from all directions. I mean, at that point,
water
that was
from here and fire from here. Anyway,
that was just, it was a lot. No, I actually want to kind of go back to your family history a little bit, if that's okay for me to ask. And Chuck was wondering, he was like, you know, are they Russian or Ukrainian, the name Romanchuk? And I'm like, pretty sure it's Ukrainian.
Yeah, so my...
So can you tell us a little bit about your family ties?
So Romanchuk is Americanized Ukrainian.
Okay.
So my grandfather, who I knew, his name was Paul, was pure Ukrainian immigrant from the Ukraine, you know, probably Russian Revolution era, you know, Pennsylvania. But it's the war, World War II. So my grandma, this is on my dad's side, Maui girl. You know, she was raised at she went to school at the old Maui High School, which is, you know, out over above Hoakipa. Mm-hmm. She lived in the house that's now the Payabe Youth Center.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, her dad being an engineer, you know, they got the nice part of Paya. You know, like there's all the
camps. Sweet spot.
And the tidal wave washed out all the other houses between there and the lime kiln. Now, even that one got picked up, spun, and put back down, but it survived the tidal wave in Paya. Anyway, so wartime, she was at the time a stewardess for Pan Am. Pan Am started flying troops to Europe. So, you know, typical, my dad's a baby boomer. He was born in Biloxi, Mississippi, as the war ended.
Wow.
So my grandpa, the Romanchuk name, so I'm a quarter Ukrainian, was just a serviceman, and my grandma from Maui met during World War II.
I see.
They moved back to Maui as soon as the war ended.
Okay.
So my dad's half Ukrainian, I'm a quarter. And there's not too many Romanchuks on, all the Romanchuks are Maui related.
Okay.
Our home, cousin, uncle.
Yeah.
There's not too many of us.
Yeah.
There is a Romanchuk, just probably another, there's a person, maybe it's a typo that day at Ellis Island, or not a typo, but couldn't read your A to a U. There's only a handful of other Romanchuks in Pennsylvania. But
the Hawaiian is through your grandma.
My grandma,
the
Maui girl.
Okay. So, I thought Abby said that the lineage was Kauai, is that?
Yeah, so my great-grandma, the one we call Kupuna, lived to be 100, was born in Koloa,
Kauai.
She was in the first graduating class of Kamehameha School when they let girls in.
I see.
Whatever year that was. And then she, you know how the Mormons kept records?
Yeah.
You know, someone related to us gave us a bunch of genealogy and stories.
Interesting.
She fled Oahu and marooned to Maui and then met Maneri, who was an engineer at the mill. They got married and...
And then they settled here eventually.
Yeah, for the rest of their lives.
I see. Okay.
So, originally,
that's so cool.
The Hawaiian is
interesting.
Kauai.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah.
And then my mom's side is kind of cool too, because I don't know if you guys have taken geology at UH.
Yeah, I was going to. So, I'm glad you brought that up. Just a weird. This is a cool story.
I never did.
So my mom was born in Arizona, but moved to Oahu when she was pretty young. I want to say 7. I could be wrong. She's from a family of 7. So she had 2 older sisters and 4 younger brothers, some of which were born, you know, on Oahu, hadn't been born yet. But the reason her family moved was her dad was a professor of geology, and a job opened up at the University of Hawaii for a geology professor.
Oh, cool.
And then he did his whole career there. And I think the legacy left that still is Volcanoes in the Sea.
Yeah.
Is that textbook I believe they still use. And so he published that with McDonald. They co-published.
Oh, cool.
But he did all kinds of volcano
Abbott,
research.
Right? Dr. Abbott. Abbott? Yes. Okay.
Yeah, so Agaton Abbott.
Yes.
ABBOTT.
And so
that's how my mom's side came here.
Right.
How cool is
and
that?
Abby has these beautiful aerial prints. Did he take them?
Those are photographs out of the plane.
Yeah. I mean, they're from what, 1960s?
Oh, God,
I think
50s?
They're in Napali Coast or
all over every volcano. I mean, flying over West Maui on a clear day.
Huge.
You know, proof that it used to be a caldera. It's just eroded. You know, it's just that era of volcanology and geology of Hawaii. Oh, we're on a seamount. I mean, there's actually, I think, a seamount named after him. Abbott Seamount is the northernmost, closest to Japan, bottom of the ocean seamount.
The oldest one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, do you think, like, did you get to know him? Was he around?
No,
when you
he
were,
passed.
Oh, okay.
Young, I knew, of course, my grandma on my mom's side, Paula, okay. But even she passed, you know, when I was sort of young. Mm-hmm. But I never knew him.
Oh, the reason why I was asking was like if he might have been an influence in.
No, I think just the lore of his work.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's an interesting time though. I mean, he did a lot of research on geothermal and like, okay, is that bad to research volcanoes and, you know, some of the weird world war, you know, it's just a different era, right? Geologists back then were basically, oh, go research this mine.
Go find us
go
some
tell us where to drill
or,
for the dam.
Yeah,
so it's
oil,
a different era.
Yeah,
so like,
much more commercial. I mean, still that way. There's commercial.
Right. But I think in my mind, we romanticize geologists now.
Yeah.
But back then they were tools for.
Yeah.
For
So we're botanists.
Right. I was going to say, but you know, he was dedicated and it was his lifelong career, and I think he did a lot, you know, as far as documenting things that scientists do.
I mean, I can't
that book alone.
Yeah. I have to say, I mean, in absentia here, Abby's not here, but I can't help but think there's so much overlap with his imagery and the interest Abby has in science and in interpreting.
Both of you's got to be that influence in terms of knowing what you know that being. You know, familiar with that kind of world to some extent, right?
Definitely.
Academia, for what it's worth.
See, I feel lucky to, you know, have parents that valued education.
Yeah. For sure.
And lucky that, you know, even with my great-great-grandma's side of the family, you know, are here.
Yeah.
And I can't think, you know, I listened to your podcast, the most recent one.
Oh, with Hannah Springer?
So many interesting things came up that I never heard about, you know. What was that fancy? Indigeneity.
That's how she started it.
She started that one.
We literally sat down and she's like, so.
Yeah, and she's talking to Howley's basically, like, how do we, answer that?
Well, I mean, we're digressing, but it's funny, right?
No, but it's all related.
I mean, a funny story about that, I wish Abby was here, is, you know, like when funny things happen and then the family keeps telling this story, so it like lives on. You've probably heard this one, Melissa. But
no,
when we're living
me.
In McKenna, you know, we're riding bikes, it's all lava, she falls. You know when blood comes out, it gets dark because it meets oxygen and turns from pregnant.
Yeah.
She goes, I think all my Hawaiian blood is in my knee. Right? Because it was darker red than she remembered blood was supposed to be.
This is what I'm talking about. That's so funny, these two.
That's the 25% or whatever it is.
No, I mean, less than that. Like, do the math. So, but it's funny, right? It's like, am I Hawaiian? Yes. But then it's also, do you speak Olelo Hawaii? I'm like, no, because when I was in school, punana leos weren't established yet.
No.
Right. We had a kupuna come in and tell ghost stories.
Yeah. Right.
You know, like that was the...
Right.
It was just a different level of cultural engagement. So I didn't grow up in Kauai, so I'm not really a taro farmer. I grew up, you know, Kula, so I'm a apple, you know, like, am I Hawaiian? I don't, it's just an interesting place to
be. Well, Katie Kamalamela, if she was here, she would say, you are enough, Ethan.
Yeah, and that's,
she would say, like, there's
Hannah
nothing to prove.
Really
well, that's the thing
too.
Is, it's just kind of like, I don't really see people.
Yeah.
I know it's easy to say when I'm a white male, but at the same time, it's just kind of like, well, you know what? Just, we're all
human.
I know. I said the same thing to her. I was like, I mean, like, it's easy for me. Of course it's easy for me, you know, but I mean, in the sense that I can't pretend to really be whatever, you know, what you're not, where, so it doesn't really matter.
I mean, we all know it's like there's white people that are more Hawaiian and they're than some Hawaiians, and you know what I mean? Like, yeah, come on, like, is it the values? That's a whole other
can of worms.
But I guess I feel grounded in who I am and where I live.
Yes. Like all that. Like, and if a Hawaiian comes up, then and then it comes up, right? As part of maybe something else. You're growing Hawaiian plants.
That. I grew apple trees too. You know,
yeah, that's right.
What is a Hawaiian plant? Like, the ones the Hawaiians brought? It's like, you know. Where do you draw the line?
Why aren't apples native to, like, that's not Ukraine, but somewhere over there, though.
Yeah, China. Well,
little east up there. Kazakhstan or something like that.
Somewhere cold.
Do you have anything, Clay? I feel like I asked all the things I wanted to ask about. I guess we should just close by saying mahalo nui loa for this amazing day and for taking us to, you know, your place and place down there and place up here.
Well, I knew I was going to have to connect with you guys at some point because I just wanted to see the nursery for so long and ask how things got started. But it didn't really occur to me to do it this way. And so I'm really stoked that Melissa thought of just, we should go, you know, do an interview. But
memorable too, because it's leap year.
Yeah.
Yes, it's leap year.
This day doesn't exist, right? We couldn't even plan this if we tried.